we not only took Dizzy's own statements, that is, that what I did was to sit down and draft questions to him on every aspect of his life, historically, and then we'd sit down and discuss those questions. We found out that that would be a nice book if we worked it that way, strictly Dizzy Gillespie. But we needed something more strong, even more strong, something that would be solid enough to call the story of Dizzy Gillespie, and in addition, give some insights on the era, the development of modern jazz. So we thought of the idea. Diz had read a book, and so had I. It was a bestseller by Merle Miller, Plain Speaking, the treatment he did of Harry Truman. And we thought that might be a good format to take off from. So I started interviewing everyone and everyone who'd ever had any acquaintance with Dizzy Gillespie of substance. Relatives, friends, old teachers, associates. I went all the way back down to South Carolina and met a very delightful woman, Ms. Alice Wilson, who was Dizzy Gillespie's third grade teacher. So we went through it that way, and finally, after 5 more years, we had it all done. And that's To Be or Not to Bop. It's a product of a lot of labor, I'll tell you that.
You did interview a lot of musicians for the book, and I'd like to hear what it was like to try to convince some of them to talk with you. I'm thinking particularly of two musicians who, for everything I know about them, are not very forthcoming as far as
interviews
talking to people or interviews or any dealings with the not only the press, but
yeah,
lots
well,
of
there
people.
Are some people, you know, jazz is a very funny business, and lots of musicians don't like, especially modern jazz musicians, are hesitant to talk to people who are not knowledgeable about the music. So I think that's one reason people get the impression that musicians don't want to talk. Then there are some people who have their personal idiosyncrasies, and these
the
people,
latter I'm referring to, yeah.
And these people you sometimes have to cajole, you sometimes have to push along, you have to talk to them softly, and they suddenly decide, well, here's a guy I'd like to talk to. And this was the case with a couple of people. I think one was Thelonious Monk.
Yeah, there's these really chatty interviews with, well, not really interviews, you don't see the questions, but you get the answers, anecdotes, stories. And the one I read with Monk, it's just a question, what did Dizzy Gillespie teach you? Oh, I don't remember. What kind of musician was he? He was very good. It's just a four-word phrase, this period. It's the shortest little interview in the book, I think.
Oh, yeah, it's very, very brief, very terse interview with Monk. I was lucky to get that much. But if you read into those lines, I think you find some of the real opinions Thelonious Monk has of Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah, I've heard he answers his phone sometimes, Monk ain't here, and he hangs up.
Hangs up. Oh, yeah, he's that way. I finally traced him to where he was living. I tried about 15 different ways of getting to him. And the way that I got that interview was by being at Carnegie Hall. I think it was during the Newport Jazz Festival, 1977. And Diz and Monk were both on the same bill. They were on the same bill that night at a concert, Thelonious Monk and Dizzy Gillespie. So I was in Dizzy's dressing room when Monk came in. And I went over to Monk's dressing room, and I sat down, and I got that one from him just before he went on stage. So it was that was the way I got the interview with Monk. He sat down, and he talked to me. Monk's just not loquacious, that's all, you know. He speaks very, very briefly, and what you have to do is find out what he has to say, and he'll say it. He's not diplomatic at all, as Dizzy would say. He comes out and says what he believes. What do you like about Dizzy Gillespie the most? His musicianship, that's what. And that's Thelonious Monk. He did tell me where he met Dizzy. He said he'd met him at the Rhythm Club, which was a musician's hangout uptown in Harlem. He did tell me some of the things that he liked about Dizzy's music. And he didn't remember any of the concepts that he and Diz had collaborated on. But he did recall, I think, that there were some things about Diz that had influenced him. You know, there was some talk about Monk being a bit miffed that Diz and Charlie Parker had gotten a great deal of credit for the creation of bebop, while he had been overshadowed for many years. It wasn't until, I guess, the early 1950s that Monk really began to get more credit than he'd been getting for a long time for the contribution he had made to modern jazz, and that contribution had been significant. That was one of the things we tried to do in this book. to set out in some detail what all of these great minds, who were the fathers of modern jazz, actually did in creating this music, because it's one whole body of music, and at the same time, it's the music of all these separate great musicians. So you've got Kenny Clarke and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk and Charlie Parker and all these great guys who came out with sounds that people were not used to hearing, who came out with a style and an accent on music that people were not used to hearing, who changed music in a very, very important way to mirror the sound of modernity. And I think that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. Did you, for your book, get to talk to Miles Davis at all?
Miles, I talked
very,
to.
Very, very difficult
Miles
to reach.
Miles was very difficult to reach. I went around to Miles' house, and I didn't go there initially. I wrote him a letter. And, of course, I understand, I don't know whether it's true or not, but I heard that Miles doesn't read his mail. You know, that the mail comes in and it goes out in the trash can. So this is what I've heard. Anyway, in desperation, I decided to visit Miles's house. I knew where he lived because I'd visited his house before. There were friends of mine who were from Washington who had lived at Miles's house in years past. And so I'd been in and out of there for many, many years. So I knocked on the door, and Miles was ill. There was something, he had a problem with his hip, you know. And he came downstairs in pajamas, and he was ready to go to war with me for coming and knocking on his door. So I said, "Look, man, you don't answer your mail. You don't answer your phone. How else is anyone going to get in touch with you?" And, you know, he said, "If you don't get away from here." And I said, "Look, Miles, you've got to be more reasonable and more rational than this." And I told him why I was there. And he said, "Well, look, contact me in the next few days," or something of that sort, at which point he again became inaccessible. So finally, Diz and I got together and broke his door down together. And we sat in there for, I don't know, for hours talking with Miles. And that interview turned out to be a very, very long one, something I'd probably like to publish outside of this book. But it was a great interview.
Let's listen to an early recording of Dizzy Gillespie's with Charlie Parker of Salt Peanuts, one of the classic collaborations. Do you want to tell us a little bit about how they met, Parker and
Yard
Gillespie?
Dizzy? Well, that's all in the book, but it happened in St. Louis. It happened in St. Louis, and the two of them got together through a mutual friend by the name of Buddy Anderson. Buddy Anderson was a hard man to reach, too. But through the Musicians Foundation out in Kansas City, I was able to get a hold of him and to talk with him on the telephone. I just met Buddy Anderson personally this year. But he was a fine musician who I understand was a trumpeter at the time, but then came down with a case of tuberculosis, and he was unable to continue playing trumpet and began playing bass. Buddy is a really, really groovy person to meet, and he was in New York this fall. I think it was in September that I ran into him at a concert that Diz was playing over in Englewood, in his hometown, Englewood, and Buddy and I got together for the first time personally, but I talked to him on the phone, and he was really open with me and told me a lot about the first meeting between Dizzy and Charlie Parker. It was a fantastic meeting, the two of them getting together and finding out that they had been pursuing the same line of thought musically, though separated by miles, you know, of territory. And they eventually got together, and when they did get together, you found a new kind of a new style of music emerging, which was really great.
Are there any stories you could share with us about how Salt Peanuts first came into being?
Salt Peanuts comes out of a riff that Dizzy Gillespie first played on a record. I think it was a record with Lucky Millinder, if I'm not mistaken. And on that record, it's not Mason Flyer, it's anyway, it's a riff that he'd set. That riff may have been set you know, there are lots of things in jazz that are that come to musicians from what are known as head arrangements. That is things that they keep in their minds, and everyone knows them because they've heard them played so often. And these things often become the basis of songs, because a guy will play the riff over and over and over again, and then he will attach other music to it, and that music will eventually become a tune on its own. So riffs may very often develop into tunes. And this is what happened with Salt Peanuts. Later on, in collaboration with Kenny Clarke, who I imagine, along with Diz, because Diz is a percussionist too, you know, got together to do the drum accents in Salt Peanuts, you know. And that's how the tune emerged. But it didn't emerge all at one time. The ba-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da, bum, you know, that's ba-da-da-da-da. I think you'll hear that. I wish I had a discography in front of me, but I don't. And you hear that on one of the tunes that Dizzy Gillespie recorded with Lucky Millinder.
What about the Salt Peanuts, the words themselves? You could tell, no?
I think you better read that one. Okay.
Couldn't clean it up for us.
Yeah, no. It's nothing dirty about it. It's it really probably has to do with... as a matter of fact, does Dizzy discuss how he named that tune? I'm not sure whether he discusses how he named that tune. Salt Peanuts is the name of the tune is Salt Peanuts, and that might probably comes from the accents. Pompano, pompano, Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts.
Okay, well, this is the one you might have heard Dizzy Gillespie sing. I guess it was about 2 years ago on the White House lawn, and he invited Carter to sing it with him. That was fun.
Yeah, it was fun. I was there that afternoon too, and Carter was completely taken aback by it.
Well, he didn't know the words because he was doing this whole thing.
All
hey,
he had to do
I
was
love
sing
jazz.
Salt
I love
Peanuts.
Jazz.
Yeah.
And he asked Carter to join him on this, and it was pretty clear that Carter was going to need a lot of coaching to figure out what he was supposed to say and when, right?
Yeah. But it didn't require that much coaching at all.
Well, it's pretty easy.
Yeah, because all he had to do was just sit there and stand there and say, Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. You know, Diz says there's a great accent. You must accent the P. You know, yeah. And it's really important because that's the way it is. That was one of the most important characteristics of their music, the accents of the music. You know, Salt Peanuts, Salt Peanuts. That's the way the horn sounds. Most of what you hear from Dizzy Gillespie in terms of lyrics is really imitation of the horn sound or imitation of the drum sound. The accents in the music and the rhythm of the music are the most important elements to him.
Okay, well, let's hear a 1945 recording of Salt Peanuts with Dizzy Gillespie along with Charlie Parker, Al Haig at the piano, Curly Russell bass, and Sid Catlett on drums.
Salt peanuts. Thank you.
1945 recording of Salt Peanuts with Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker. Gillespie has been an interesting character in bop. One of the almost contradictions, in a way, of his music was the combination of clowning and of really serious music that a lot of people found very difficult. I mean, a lot of people were really scared by bop, I think, when it started being played. And some people say yes and some people say no. But he even tells the story in your book about when they started taking the big band to southern clubs, and it wasn't the blues and it wasn't big band dance music, and no one knew what to do with it, and no one liked it at first. And the big band just wasn't working. On the other hand, he was, of the bop musicians, the clown. He's the one who did things like Ooh Bop Shabam and Ooh Scooby Dooby and things that sound like Calloway would have done them. And he, in fact, played in Cap Calloway's band. How do you think he's seen himself in terms of entertainer and serious musician?
Well, we explain that in the book. Dizzy has always been a comical person. He's never been, as far as I've been able to find out, Diz has always been the kind of guy who has made people laugh. So it's a natural part of Dizzy Gillespie to make people laugh and to be jubilant about the world and about what's going on around him. So that's a part of why Dizzy Gillespie is a comedian as well as a musical genius. So I think he's really, really, he's got a genius in both areas. He has his particular kind of humor. And right now, what I'm trying to do is to excerpt a lot of material that I did not use in the book that is very, very comic to put together in another work, compile for another work called Dizzy's Wits, that deals with Dizzy Gillespie's humor. Diz also took a cue from another great musical genius who was comedic as well. And his name was Thomas Fats Waller. So you find in the music of the 1930s and in even the music of the 1920s, a lot of musicians who added to their act and to their presentation or performances different aspects of their personalities. Jazz is not just getting up on the stage and playing the instrument. It involves the total personality of the performer. And because of that, I think you found a lot of guys who express themselves in different ways. Each one of these men, you notice, has his own idiosyncrasies. He has his own idea of how he should be in the world. And it's this kind of existential outlook, if you wish, that leads Dizzy Gillespie to be Dizzy Gillespie and no one else, and that includes all of Dizzy Gillespie's humor. So you get a lot of that. Another reason is a technical reason, I think. And that technical reason is that he feels that a lot of people, if they're too tensed up, can't really enjoy his music. So the music is there to relax them and to make them enjoy themselves, but also to force them to think along with him. And because of this, he feels that when they're relaxed, most is just after they've had a laugh. So he lays, if you ever go to Dizzy Gillespie's performances, you notice there's the laugh and then there's the music. There's the laugh and then there's the music. So that's Diz, the laughter and the music of life. because that's what he symbolizes.
Does he feel that he's had to make any large concessions to the commercial demands of the business?
He doesn't feel he's had to make too many great commercial sacrifices of his musical talent. I think there are some records he's not exactly happy with, but I'm not sure that he really feels he did not express himself as a musician on those recordings. He is the kind of man who is very, very outgoing, very, very easygoing. So he's not one to make an issue of something if it arises that someone wants him to do something he's not exactly sure he wants to do. He'll probably try it and then find out he really didn't want to do it.
He's gone from being the young, uncontrollable clown in the Calloway band to being the young upcoming star of,
this was never a clown,
the vanguard in bebop. Now he's like the old, not the old man of jazz, but I'm not quite sure of the word I'm thinking of.
The elder statesman?
Elder statesman of jazz, yeah.
Well, you know, like, yeah, that'll happen, if you're that great and you live that long.
Yeah, well, I wonder how he feels about about suddenly being the elder statesman and not the young person anymore.
He's not suddenly the elder statesman. He's had to live through all that. So I think he deserves all the plaudits he receives, and I think that his status in jazz now is that of a man who has made tremendous contributions, which musicians and the people who are knowledgeable about jazz appreciate. Because of that, Dizzy Gillespie is the elder statesman, or is an elder statesman. You've got some other elder statesmen around, Count Basie, for one, and certainly old man Hubie Blake. But in terms of the eras that they have been performing in, most recent era where we've had men to grow to great age has been the modern age, and Dizzy Gillespie is one of the greatest of that era. I think he stands foremost among the founding fathers of modern jazz, and that's the I think pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm. It's a period in which a lot of his contemporaries didn't make it, didn't survive.
Yeah, that was very, very unfortunate. Not only was it unfortunate, it was absolutely it was horrible to have men of that talent not be appreciated in a country where they were making great contributions to the artistic life of the population, or not be compensated for the kinds of contributions they were making. Jazz has never received, I don't think, its due, and I think Dizzy feels that way too, because it's been created primarily by Afro-Americans. And America historically has had such a terrible racist bias that it has not wanted to accept the contributions of Afro-Americans to culture, because if you accepted the contributions of these great artists, then it became difficult to say that they were lesser people. And the America continues and continued to pretend that people who were making really great contributions to art and culture were lesser people. That discouraged a lot of people, and it drove them into sometimes activities that might have been destructive, self-destructive. There was, during the 1940s, the beginning of a kind of upsurge in drug use. Although I understand during the 1920s there were a lot of drugs around too, it did not exist as much in the musical community as it did during the 1940s, where when bands passed through the Holland Tunnel coming into New York, they'd be stopped by police and everyone would be checked to find out whether or not they were carrying drugs. When the whole of 52nd Street, where a lot of jazz was being produced, was kind of sacked by Rockefeller, who then wanted to build to turn it into office buildings, turn that whole area into office buildings, because 52nd Street was not supposed to be a kosher place to be, and the kinds of things that were happening there were thought not to be good for the public well-being. I think Diz suffered because of some of this, but there were others who suffered even more than he, and Charlie Parker was surely one of them. Because of that, a lot of people's talent was destroyed, and I think we make note of that in the book. People who you might not have even heard of, men who might have simply stopped playing, or who were forced into hospitals for drug addiction or that kind of thing, who were not able to get it together. On the other hand, there were those who were able to get it together, who found themselves trapped in drugs or trapped in alcohol, and who then overcame these obstructions and went on to become great musicians.